Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720. Chicago, it's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We've got a lot to do tonight as we have our special program on Alzheimer's and dementia, which is coming up in just a second. I just wanted to say, if you have been paying attention to the news or haven't, that the Chicago teachers' strike is going on day two, as the Chicago Teachers Union said they do plan to strike a second day, which will be tomorrow morning. So there is no school for Chicago public school students. The same applies today, that you can send your kids to the school, and there will be administrators and staff there too, as we were talking about. It's not school, but it's kind of a, playtime, maybe? I love listening to the mayor, and I think it was the CPS chief, talking about enriched activities. And from my time in school, whenever there was enriched activities, that was a bag full of used balls that were thrown out into the middle of the gym, and we'll be back in a couple of hours. So I think that might be a little bit of what is happening at CPS schools. But they are going to strike for the second day, although there has been some consideration and there has been some movement in the negotiations. But
in their words, not enough.
Not enough, right. So, but that's a good sign that they're at least starting to talk to each other and make some concessions on both sides. And we, of course, will pay attention to that news and pay attention tonight if anything breaks on that story. So that's Chicago teacher strike going into day two tomorrow here in Chicago. Like I said, we'll be all over that. David Jennings is here tonight, Pete Zimmerman as well, and I'm Justin Kaufman. We've been planning tonight's program for a while now, a program to talk about Alzheimer's. And every time I mention it or I cut a promo or put something up on social media, the stories would pour in. The truth is that Alzheimer's may be the sixth most common cause of death in the U.S., but this disease, it's really about the living. Relatives, spouses, loved ones, it's hard for any of us to walk into this world without the disease affecting us. I just lost my grandmother last year to dementia, watched Alzheimer's turn into dementia, watched the toll it took on my family, my mom, my dad, as they tried to give the very best care up to the last minute. But I realized in that ordeal that our family was not alone. Millions of families go through this every single year. The estimates are there are 5.8 million Americans living with the disease, and that number will rise to 14 million by 2050. And the cost of that care in 2050, the cost will be well over $1.1 trillion. Tonight, our program is dedicated to the stories of those living with Alzheimer's and dementia. We talk with one man, Jim Butler, who was recently diagnosed. We'll talk with the man, Regan Hogarty, who just lost his father, Dennis. We'll talk with our Lieutenant Governor, Juliana Stratton, who's going all over the state to listen to stories of Alzheimer's, but both as part of her job, but also to honor her mother, Velma. And we profile the call center and some of the operators at the Alzheimer's Association that lend their voice to the most in need. It's a special Extension 720 tonight. We expect to hear from you, because we know that you have a story to tell as well. 312-981-7200. In studio with me tonight from the Alzheimer's Association Illinois chapter is Melanie Chavin. She's a Chiefs Program Officer. Melissa Tucker, she's a Director of Family Services. And Patrick Reedy, who's the Executive Director of the Illinois chapter. They're all here in studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Justin. We appreciate
Thanks for having
it.
Us.
All right, so let's get right into it. I think the best course of action is we have all this stuff tonight to talk about and all these stories, but I think the best would just to talk about the Alzheimer's Association and first off talk about Alzheimer's. I mean, what is this disease?
Sure. So Alzheimer's disease is one of the types of dementia. So if you think about dementia as an umbrella of symptoms, there can be several different causes. Alzheimer's disease is the most common. So about 70-80% of the reason behind dementia is Alzheimer's disease. But there's also vascular dementia, Lewy body disease, and several others. So the Alzheimer's Association is committed to taking care of those living with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, and also finding a cure for those.
Yeah.
And that's our commitment to, like you said, the millions of Americans living with the disease today and their caregivers.
There's something to be said that, so many people have had to go through the education, and then the re-education because it affects their family. But you still have a lot of shrouded mystery around Alzheimer's and what it is. How important is it just on education, the idea of really getting Americans to know what this disease is?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's so important because people come into this not knowing what it's going to be like. They don't know what the resources are. People have a lot of questions. They wonder, what do I have to do now? What should I plan for if I get the diagnosis? People have an idea that you get that diagnosis and then your entire life is over and boom, you're giving up the car keys and going into a nursing home. And there's a lot of living between the diagnosis and the time at which you have to have a more structured environment. So it is really important, that planning, that talking. The more that we can talk about it too, the mm-hmm. more that we're going to reduce that stigma and the isolation, which is part of what makes it so hard to live with this illness.
That stigma, that's the word. I mean, it's amazing to think about it. As my family went through it, to think about other family members, like uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters who were like, well, what is this? What, not knowing anything about it and almost shying away from it because of the stigma.
Yeah, and there is still a stigma about the disease. I think part of what we're working very, very hard to do, though, is to help people to understand that they're not alone. And I think participating in Alzheimer's Association education programs, contacting our 24/7 helpline, just getting involved with the association can help you to feel and understand that you are not alone. There are a lot of people that are dealing with this disease.
Okay, so I mentioned the stats, and it kind of blows my mind. We're going to talk a little bit about this tonight, but a lot of articles written in the last couple months about what's coming, meaning there's going to be more and more diagnoses than we've ever seen in history. We've seen a ballooning of numbers. I think it was used 5.8 million now, 14 million in 30 years. That's an extraordinary number. Why is that? Why are we seeing estimates being ballooning up so fast and so big in such a short amount of time?
Sure. Well, most of that's driven by the aging of our population. But that's just one cause. One of the things that the Alzheimer's Association is committed to in our six-pillar strategic plan is raising concern and awareness for the disease. So a lot of those statistics that you shared earlier come from our facts and figures report mm-hmm. that we put out each year. We don't do that to scare people or to cause people undue concern. But we know that there's a gap between the realities of this disease, sixth leading cause of death, as you mentioned, those startling statistics about where we will go if we don't alter the path of this disease by the year 2050. And so there are a couple of reasons that we do that. First of all, to reduce the stigma, to help people understand that they're not in this alone. We'll have a chance, I think, later to talk about our Walk to End Alzheimer's in a couple of weeks and, a great opportunity for people to see, down at Soldier Field, the magnitude that mm-hmm. that this community affects, but also to help raise awareness for funding for the disease. We'll talk, I think, hopefully later about federal funding for research. So really, those statistics should alarm all of us, but we're not helpless in this. We have some really sound plans that are critical to the work that we're doing to bend that curve.
I always, when you think about this story too, it's as the numbers look to explode, there's still the kind of thing hanging over is just the idea there is no cure. There is no even treatment for this. And I think that's what scares people when they see that and article after article comes out about how if you change your diet, maybe that'll work. If you change your sleep habits, maybe that'll work. All this other stuff. But I think that there is this dread, this idea that there is no cure. And that's why I think there may be a lot of stigma around it.
Yeah, that's really true. That's why people are afraid. We have really been advocating and pushing for an early diagnosis. If you have any concerns about your memory, please talk to your doctor about that right away. And we want to give people a chance to do planning if it turns out that that's what's going on. If it's not dementia, if there's some other thing that's causing memory impairment or confusion, obviously you'd want to get that treated. But unfortunately, there are medications that can help support people, have a better quality of life, sustain some of that function in the brain for a little bit longer, but it doesn't reverse the illness or treat it. So we are really looking a lot at lifestyle choices, things that you can do. We always say what's good for the heart is mm-hmm. good for the brain. We're really looking at things like exercise has been one of the few things that's been shown to slow cognitive decline, and that's as little as 30 minutes of walking 5 times a week. That's one of the things that we know is helpful. Being socially engaged, dealing with things like diabetes, if you have that, and sleep. That's come out recently, and I think we can all take steps to sleep better.
And it's also, you're really just in a spot where, we're talking about slowing the disease as mm-hmm. opposed to curing it. In studio, the Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois chapter, Melanie Chavin, Melissa Tucker, and Patrick Reedy. We're talking about Alzheimer's tonight here on Extension 720, 312-981-7200. We'll take our first break. When we come back, let's hear the story of Jim Butler, who was just diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and he tells his story first person coming up here on Extension 720. So stay with us. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It is our Alzheimer's special tonight. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Melanie Chavin, Melissa Tucker, and Patrick Reedy are in studio from the Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois chapter, and we will be taking your calls and talking more about Alzheimer's and dementia coming up here on the program. Before we do that, though, I want to bring you the story of Jim Butler. Jim was diagnosed with Alzheimer's a couple years back, and he was gracious enough to let us come to his home and talk to him about what he's facing and tell his story. So here's Jim.
My name is Jim Butler. I'm 71 years old. I was diagnosed almost exactly 3 years ago. What I knew about the diagnosis, or what I knew about Alzheimer's, was my experience with my dad. Well, my dad first started to show signs of confusion and forgetting and that kind of stuff, and that confusion and that memory loss that we were seeing in our dad turned into Alzheimer's some years later, and he ended up dying with that in Florida years later. I got diagnosed 3 years ago, but I was kicking that can down the road for probably a year prior to that. I had found myself having increasing frequency of forgetfulness and confusion. I had an incident with my iPhone and a crash, and I ended up at the Apple Store on North Avenue. And I'm not Mr. Tech to begin with, but I could hardly cope with what they were. That my phone needed to get replaced. And that whole experience at the Apple Store, I couldn't even follow what the heck the tech at the Apple Store was telling me to do and how to do my part of getting this new phone populated. And I just found that I was so befuddled and so unable to kind of do my part in that process, even to any appropriate degree, that I got to. We have a place in Michigan that we spend our weekends at, and I drove to Michigan with no GPS and none of that kind of stuff because it wasn't on my phone yet. And I got there, and I was my wife was there, and some friends of ours, that dear friends of ours, were spending the holiday weekend with us. And I went and I sat down. I said, "Guys, I got something going on, and I need to reach out to my doctor at Northwestern and find out what the heck is going on." I said, "It's confusion and that kind of stuff," and I did. I did it right after that.
When you got the diagnosis, what was your emotion? What was your reaction?
I was devastated. I mean, I thought about my dad and where my dad ended up, and I thought more about where my dad ended up rather than the years prior to that when he was getting there. I feel enormously more optimistic about my condition now. I've learned about it. I've learned a lot over the last 3 years. Initially, I got proactive because I was scared. The more I was in this and the more I learned, I got less scared and more appreciative of learning what this diagnosis is all about or what it can be. My life now is like, and I'm still the same person that I was, but my priorities about life and what's important to me about life and what's rewarding to me about life has changed enormously, and it is all about people and connection with people. And for a long time, every day I refer to them as hiccups, you know, but it's periods of confusion. What did I walk in this room to get? Or I'd pick up something to do, and something that came to me automatically forever is now something I have to sit down and think about. Well, what's step one? What's step two? Kind of thing. And I've learned to smile at that kind of stuff, and instead of getting frustrated, scared, angry, I smile at it. I think, okay, Jim, you're beating this thing a little bit. Getting humbled, my experience in getting humbled, and that's what I feel humbled by this diagnosis, has allowed me to evolve in lots of ways, and darn near all of them are really, really good ways, and so that's a pretty good little payoff from where I pretty little return on investment or whatever. It's it's been I'm grateful for it. So I'm yeah.
Jim Butler, we thank you for letting us come into your home and for telling your story. The panel that's in the studio, and that's Melanie Chavin, Melissa Tucker, Patrick Creedy. Before we take our break here, you hear Jim's story, and what comes to mind? I mean, it has to be a story you hear a lot.
Yeah, and we're always so grateful when people like Jim are willing to come out and speak about the fact that they've been diagnosed in public, because that helps so many people who are worried or afraid. And to hear him say, you know, I am living my life and I'm living a good life and there have been gifts in this for me is so important. And we're so grateful to him.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. We want to hear your story. And tonight we're going to talk about, you know, being diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but we're also going to talk about caregiving. And we're also going to talk about the people who help on. We had a chance to check out the call center and be able to talk about what's happening at the Alzheimer's Association on Michigan Avenue. Again, 312-981-7200. We want to hear your story here on Extension 720, a special program tonight about Alzheimer's on 720 WGN. Thanks, David. It's Extension 720, 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. We're talking about Alzheimer's tonight in our special program. It's our topic tonight until 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200. We got some people on the line, Claire and Gilda and Randy. I'm going to get to you guys in just a second. Melanie Chavin, Melissa Tucker, and Patrick Reedy from the Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois chapter, are in studio with me tonight. We heard right before the news the story of Jim, and we kind of, you know, he hit on a couple of themes in there. You know, he said, and some of the callers reflected this as well, but he said, you know what, I was diagnosed, but I've been kicking that can down the road for a while. You hear that a lot, that people recognize they may have symptoms to Alzheimer's, but they don't want to go get tested.
Certainly people are afraid of getting tested, and family members, I think, also don't want to bring this up. It's hard to bring up to your husband or wife or your parent, you know, I think there's something wrong. So people really hesitate to do that. And then the doctors sometimes don't bring it up, so then nobody's talking about it. It's this unspoken situation that people are aware of, but no one's moving forward.
Well, what do you do? How do you get the public aware of that? What, you know, because we've seen this in other diseases. I think of prostate cancer or colon cancer comes to mind, where there has been a real push, an education, if you will, almost this idea that doctors say it has to be at a certain time, you have to get a test. Is that going to be the future of Alzheimer's, where there is more of the medical community comes together and says, this is when we start testing for this?
Well, we're doing a lot of outreach to health systems and to physicians themselves to talk to them about recognizing the signs and symptoms and people and how to handle it. You know, one of the biggest concerns, we did a study last year and found out that, you know, there is a, in the Medicare annual wellness visit, there's supposed to be a component where there's a memory testing, and that doesn't happen. And we were wondering why. And it turns out that physicians are waiting for the person to ask for it, while the person is waiting for the physician to ask for it. So part of what we're trying to do is to work with physicians and let them know, you just need to do this. You need to do that testing and not wait for someone to ask for it. And telling people when you're in your physician's office to insist on it, to say, yeah, I know this is something that's supposed to happen.
When we're talking about testing, and Jim mentioned this as well to us at his home, was just about how long the testing can take. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not something that is a blood test and you come back in a couple days. There's a lot that goes into this test.
Yeah, that's right. We recommend that people get a thorough diagnostic workup, and that includes blood work, brain imaging, psychocognitive testing for the memory, and also family history. You want to see if there's drug interactions causing what's going on. You really want a comprehensive view. It's not just a snapshot of where they are with that memory right at that moment.
And that's why the funding for research is so important too, Justin, because we need to do better with biomarkers, so ways that we can earlier in the progression of the disease find low-cost, easily accessible tests that we can do that'll help us determine what this is, in addition to some of the tests that Melissa just described. And that's work that other diseases have made much faster progress on than us, and we have a huge commitment to it through our research and the research that's being done by the NIH.
All right, well, I promised that we get to some phone calls, so let's do that. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Gilda. Gilda, you're on the line. What's your question, Gilda?
You know, they did a great job of taking that question, but it gives me an opportunity to say thank you. The education piece is just so critical. It was 40 years ago that my father came down with Alzheimer's, and the toll on my mother because there just wasn't the education about it. What is it? And that just made it so much worse. So hearing Jim's story because and your efforts, I just think, I just want to say thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Gilda. Thank you. So that thought, this idea of education, that's something that you were nodding your head about.
Very much so. Gilda, thank you for your kind words. The Alzheimer's Association is very, very committed to making sure that people have the proper information and education that they need. So in addition to some of the other resources that we have available, you can reach out to your local chapter and find out about educational programs that are available. And those are available online. They're available via webinars. They're available in the community delivered by volunteers. So do contact us. We really feel it's important that people understand this disease. It'll give you a much better future with it.
I always think, too, that people, you know, I think the stigma is there that they don't understand the disease or people don't want to talk about it. But it's false. It's false in the way that we all talk about it. I can't tell you how much it affected my family, and I tell David Jennings or I tell Pete or other people, and we start to talk about it. Everybody has some connection to Alzheimer's or at least the symptoms that we're talking about. So it's strange to me to think that nobody wants to talk together about it.
Every time I mention that I work for the Alzheimer's Association, I hear a story, you know, in the Uber, you know, going out places at a dinner party. I say the word Alzheimer's and then I hear all the stories. And it is so important to talk about it. One of the greatest resources that I think we provided people are support groups. We have caregiver support groups all over the country. You can call the helpline and get a referral for that. And you're there with other caregivers. They're all led by volunteers, most of whom have been caregivers themselves. So they're members of that community. They know what they're talking about, and people can have that experience of sharing what they're going through, and that's really important.
Yeah,
I think it's a really interesting discussion. You know, when you hear Jim, it's hard to imagine a better spokesperson than him and how elegantly and eloquently he describes, you know, his process and what he's going through, and we're so grateful for him and the thousands of other people who lend their voice to this story. And I don't think it's that people don't want to talk about it. I think it's that people don't want to bring it up. You know, and once it's brought up, and that's why I think we have this unbelievable privilege and platform to really have these conversations. I think people have concerns. They're worried about it. It's just not something that comes up as often. So I think we really have an opportunity through people like Jim to tell that story.
Yeah.
And you and
but why?
Your family story.
Well, why not? I mean, I living through it, and again, it's not, I don't feel shame about it. I don't feel embarrassed about it. At a certain point, you recognize the connection. You have millions and millions of people. So why aren't we talking? Why aren't we bringing it up?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's thanks to the platform here today. You know, I think you can hear people talking positively about it with hopefulness in terms of the research, in terms of the care and support that we provide. You know, I think that helps mm-hmm. people feel better talking about it when they know, you know, there are ways that we can have positive conversations about it. I think sometimes people feel like they're in this alone, you know, and then like you said, once it comes up, you start making those connections.
You know, what Jim said in the interview, and I didn't get a chance to get it in the piece, but He mentioned something that I wanted to ask you guys about. He had said when he talked about what he's thinking about short term in his life in the next 10, 20 years, he talked about the burden that he was going to put on his family. Is that, you know, you start thinking about the emotions and the feelings and the thoughts of people who've been diagnosed. And that's something that I don't know necessarily gets brought up a lot, but that fear that they're going to become a burden.
Right. We hear that from so many people. And that is one of the reasons why I think people don't talk about it. People are afraid, not just because it's a terminal illness, but because they don't want to be a burden. We really value independence, you know, in our culture. We don't want to need things. We don't want to have to ask people for help. That feels very vulnerable. It's hard for people to do that. It's hard for people to think about a time when they're going to become dependent on their children. You know, they are always saying, you know, my kids have their own lives. So I think that dependency is and that fear of that is a big part of that emotion and why it's so important to have that conversation with somebody. One of the things we do is we have family appointments with people and everybody can talk. And so many times what I'm hearing from the adult children is that I want to help. It's a privilege. I'm doing this because I love you. And you can have those conversations and get past some of that fear.
Yeah, we're going to hear really from Regan important. A little bit later on the same topic. But it's something that I keep coming back to because to listen to him, to Jim talk and to think about, you know, how he is taking it step by step and then talking about, you know, approaching it with a smile and not getting, I think he used the word jammed up. mm-hmm. not getting frustrated, not getting angry. Those are all that is a process. And I feel like with when we talk about the disease, we rarely talk about the process that the people who have it have to go through. We may talk about, how the impact it has on our family or the deterioration of skills and cognitive skills. But that process and what Jim's talking about, getting inside of the struggle that he has, that's important.
It is important. And with Jim, I mean, he has really taken the bull by the horns, right? He is a spokesperson for us. I mean, obviously, he was on this show, you know, talking about his experience. He serves on our national early stage advisory group. So he's advising the Alzheimer's Association as to what our strategy should be working with early stage people out there. And I think for a lot of early stage folks, contacting the Alzheimer's Association, finding volunteer roles with us, being able to talk about their disease, I think it's very empowering for them. Helps them to feel a sense of control.
Yeah. 312-981-7200. And there's some people on the line, and I want to get into the stories. Randy's has a question about his wife with dementia, and I've got a lot of texts coming in as well. And we're going to get to all that tonight. This is what this show is about. It's about all of us kind of having a shared conversation about Alzheimer's so we can have a better understanding. There is the walk that is coming up on October 26th, which is Soldier Field, and we'll get all the details of that coming up here. But we're talking about Alzheimer's tonight in studio with us from the Alzheimer's Association, which is right around the corner here. Melanie Chavin, Melissa Tucker, and Patrick Reedy. We'll continue the conversation here on Extension 720, so give us a ring, 312-981-7200, and we'll continue. For the panel, I'm getting a lot of texts and calls, and I think this probably would be a good time just to go back to the top. But I'm getting a lot about the differences between Alzheimer's and dementia. We kind of talked about it right at the top, but let's reset and answer that question. What is the difference?
So dementia is the collection of symptoms that involve memory impairment, sometimes personality change, loss of executive function, and that syndrome, that disease, is caused by a number of different disease processes. So we say it's an umbrella term, right? Dementia is an umbrella term. Alzheimer's is the most frequent cause of dementia, but there's also vascular dementia, Lewy body, frontal temporal lobe degeneration. All of those are forms of dementia that cause that memory impairment.
Got it. So Alzheimer's goes into dementia, like the umbrella. 312-981-7200. I want to get to all the calls. I also want to play this story. I'm going to play this interview now. Regan Hogarty graciously let us come to his office to talk to about his dad and being a caregiver. He just lost his father last year, who had went through Alzheimer's into dementia. And I think this is as we make transition from the feelings of the people who are going through it to also representing the family around. This is a good story to play now. So let's hear a part of the interview with Regan Hogarty, who's talking about his dad.
My dad was Dennis Hogarty. He suffered for about 10 years. We lost him in February when we like to say he won his battle against Alzheimer's.
Why do you say that? Why do you say he won his battle?
You know, he's in a better place. He really is. It was a disease that took, I mean, Dennis Hogarty was a force. I mean, he was such a personality. And as the disease progressed, more and more of that got taken away. And so when he died, we were all there by his side. I thought, hey, maybe we'd have this moment of clarity, you know, that he'd get up and say something to us. And that did not happen. What did happen as we were there is he took kind of his final breath, and my sisters and I were in the room, and he just did. And right then, I felt this calmness. I'm like, you're back. You're back. Dennis Hogarty's back. I never foresaw that, but it was an unbelievable feeling.
When was the first time that you recognized symptoms or that your dad was going through this?
My dad had it for 10 years. We admitted it for 8. So probably 2 years before we decided to really admit or bring ourselves to admit to it, some of the more routine questions became more incessant. Hey, what time's dinner? And not but a minute later. Hey, what time's dinner? Not but a minute later. You know, what time's dinner? Or forgetting some of my older nieces and nephews' names. But, you know, my dad was never a real memory guy. He was a sales guy, right? He was just kind of always out there and people just loved him. But that's when we really noticed. And then as it progressed, when he turned 65, we all just kind of sat down with him and said, Dad, you know, he was a guy that was never going to retire. Mm-hmm. He was going to work till the day he died because he loved working.
When you say 10 years and 8 that you admitted, did he have to admit or did you?
We did in order to confront him. And then...
How hard was that?
It was awful. My dad was my best friend. He was the best man at my wedding. So I have 3 older sisters. And so we were very, very close. And, you know, at first it was like, you know, I don't think I have this. But if you guys are saying it, then, you know, maybe there's something to it. And then once he did admit it, he looked at my mom and said, it's all about acceptance, positive attitude, and make a plan. Then we joked. He looked at my mom and said, ooh, that was pretty good. He ran and got a pen so we didn't forget what he just said. he wrote it down. So, and throughout this whole experience, we added a little bit of levity because that's what our family's always done. And that really progressed through the day he died. The day he passed, he had been in a community for about a year and a half. And every nurse technician came in sharing a tear and a laugh because they knew the time was close. The head of maintenance wrote a prayer, personal prayer, came in and said, do you mind if I read this with your dad? We prayed a lot together. And it was just, he was maybe 40% of the Dennis Hogarty that we knew going into that community.
Right.
But he quickly became everybody's favorite.
When you're going through this and your family's going through this and it's before you get to the idea of extended care or even to the last moments of his life, how difficult was it for you as a caregiver to not only administer care but to recognize what was happening?
That's probably the hardest part. The thing about Alzheimer's is you lose a bit of them every day. You're experiencing more and more loss, and sometimes that may be harder. My mom really took the brunt of it. And then finally, when we saw it really taking a toll on her and our family's very close, we just said to her, Mom, we need to make this change because we need to get Dad into a community. And it is a community. It's not a facility. These are not facilities. Right. These are people that care. They are special people, and they do it every single day. And this is their passion.
Is it difficult for you to remember your dad as your dad as opposed to who he was during the process?
Yeah. So it's funny to say, I was blessed enough to give the eulogy. And you know what? It was hard to remember the Dennis Hogarty that he was during the process. But the moment he died, I said to everyone in the eulogy, we were given a gift. It was almost like these flood of memories just came rolling back. I got to tell you, man, it was weird. Kind of like the calmness that I experienced right when he passed. I mean, the memories. And my sisters and I stayed up that night and just laughed and cried. And then laughed and cried and repeat,
Right.
And those are things that were, Justin, those are hard to remember when you're in the thick of it, Because you're looking at this person. I always said, it could take his mind, it'll never take his soul. But that mind was, when you're losing it, it's just tough.
What do you want to say to someone who might be listening right now who may have just got a diagnosis or a family member may have or about to start or in the middle of that process?
I would say get involved with events like The Walk and support from people like you and, more awareness. We will find a cure and we will one day live in a world without Alzheimer's and we'll have all of you guys to thank for it.
How do you want your dad to be remembered?
The force that he was. When I think of the force that my dad was, I thank people saying, thank you for remembering him of the man that he was and not what this disease robbed him of. Because like I said, it'll never rob him of his soul. But you can remember that force. You can remember the Dennis Hogarty, the gregarious, outgoing, one-of-a-kind guy. For people to have that gift, I'm very blessed with that.
That's Regan Hogarty talking about his father, Dennis, as we talk about Alzheimer's tonight and dementia here on Extension 720. 312-981-7200. There's some great stuff on the phones. I can see Samantha and Randy and Claire who are standing by. But I want to go to the panel. When you hear Regan talk about his relationship with his dad as a caregiver, but also as a son, those are stories as well that, not unlike what we heard with Jim, that resonate that you hear over and over.
Yeah, well, you've picked some great stories to share tonight. You can tell we're just so fortunate to have people in this community like Regan and his family who are proud. You met with him. You can tell he's just so proud to have known his dad and to have him as such a big part of his life. And for him to channel the emotions that he and his family went through into the work that he's doing, he's a member of our board of directors. Great quick story. He was sitting with his family, watching The Walk a few years ago on TV. There was a quick news take. And he said, we got to go down there. And you can see him doing that, right? He loaded all his kids, four kids in the car, and they came down. And ever since then, he's been a huge supporter. So just to see people channel their grief, their anger, all the emotions that they go through into the great work that thousands of families and millions of families now do to help is really inspiring.
We only have a quick minute. We'll talk more in the 8 o'clock hour, but just also, trying to wrestle with when he's talking to his dad saying that we think you have it and he has to come to terms with that. He has to come to grips and make a plan.
Yeah, and that is so hard. And a lot of times, if you delay that diagnostic process, the person with dementia loses the ability to recognize that they have this. So people ask us, like, what can we say to convince my mom that she has dementia? And if you wait too long, that's not going to happen. She's not going to have the awareness while she's able to do anything about it.
The phone number, 312-981-7200. Everybody on the line, we'll hit the news. We'll come back. I guarantee we're going to get to you tonight. Melanie Chavin, Melissa Tucker, and Patrick Reedy are in studio from the Alzheimer's Association Illinois chapter. It's a special program tonight here on Extension 720, so stay with us. 312-981-7200, the phone number here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Extension 720 special tonight. We're talking about Alzheimer's and dementia for the entire program. 312-981-7200. I'm going to get to the calls in just a second here. Melanie Chavin, Melissa Tucker, and Patrick Reedy are in studio. They're with the Alzheimer's Association of Illinois, or in the Illinois chapter. And we'll get into what that all means. Had a chance to go over to the call center the other day, and we put a piece together. We'll listen to a little bit later in the program. But we're with until 10 o'clock tonight talking about this disease and also everything that surrounds it when it comes to caregiving. We heard from Regan talking about diagnosis. We heard from Jim. And, of course, just being able to share these stories and come together and support each other as this becomes much more of a presence in everybody's lives, regardless of age, because of what it can do to families. And that's what we're talking about tonight. So let's get right into it. Let's go to Samantha. I know you've been holding for a while. Samantha, thanks for joining the program.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so tell us your story. What do you want to talk to the panel about?
So my father, first of all, I want to say it was so great to hear the positive stories of Jim and Regan that we just heard. My father is the opposite. he is a very, I'm sure they are too, but he's a very proud and independent man. He's 80 years old. He has not been diagnosed. He has a lot of confusion. For example, Jim's story reminded me he can't talk to his cable service on the phone because he gets very confused and very angry with them. And, you know, it's their problem and that kind of thing. He's very forgetful. In a 5-minute conversation, he will ask the same question, you know, 2 or 3 times. And my brother and I are especially concerned. Recently, he's still driving, and he gets these rage episodes when he's driving. And, you know, he's a danger to himself and others. And how do my brother and I, you know, convince this wonderful, proud, independent man to, you know, to go to a doctor and to start this process?
Great. Thank you so much, Samantha, for asking that question. What do you think, Melanie?
So this is a question, a situation that we hear about a lot. And one thing I want to mention right now is that we have a 24-hour helpline. So for those of you who aren't calling in or aren't able to get through, you can ask this exact same question. It's 1-800-272-3900. Their counselor or social worker is at that number 24 hours a day, and they can talk you through this. So this is what I want to say to you about your situation is, you know, you have to take those car keys away, right? You've said he's a danger to himself and others. And if you're waiting to be able to convince him to agree to this, you know, that's not going to happen. So unfortunately, what people have to do is they have to start stepping in and making those decisions to keep their father safe. You know, you have to keep your father safe and everyone safe. Does he live alone?
Let me put Samantha back on. Go ahead, Samantha.
Yes, he does live alone.
Okay. So, you know, this is not a great situation, right? And I'm sure you're aware of that. And if he's not willing to go to the doctor and he is becoming very agitated and you're noticing that he is having these, you know, episodes of what you're describing as rage on the road, you know what? He may need to be hospitalized if he's so agitated. We tell people sometimes you have to call the paramedics and explain what's going on and have him taken to the hospital. He might be diagnosed there. Now, that's not something anybody wants to happen. That's not something you want to do with your father. But, you know, I know you love your father and you want to preserve his independence and his dignity, but it sounds like you're recognizing that what has to happen right now is that you need to keep him safe. And you and your brother need to make decisions to keep him physically safe. And once you've done that, then you can work on giving him the best quality of life that he can have. Yeah. But it sounds like he's past the point where you can have a rational conversation with him about the decisions that he's going to make. You may physically need to take the car keys in the car away.
Always hard. Thanks, Samantha, for sharing. Appreciate it.
Can I just jump into
Thank you so much.
Great advice for Melissa. Thank you. Those are hard conversations to have. And I just want to echo, we don't want people to have to go through these very difficult decisions, very difficult conversations alone. That's why something like the helpline is so critical. Yeah. It's always available. I'll repeat the number. I think it's that important, 800-272-3900. And I know you'll help us tell that story more later, but it's just a critical resource.
To listen people. To, I mean, it's so difficult. And I know, because the last thing you want to do is call the authorities on your dad.
Right.
And I get the idea of it, this is right at the core of what we're talking about when it talks to stigma, or these decisions are really hard. I don't know what Samantha's relationship is like with her father, but that's a very difficult thing to do if you have family dynamics.
And I think, too, you know, speaking, not only do I work for the association, but I've had family experience with this, you know, and I had a not quite similar situation with my mom when she was around. But, you know, there's no way that I could get her to the doctor by cajoling her or asking her permission. I just had to make the appointment and tell her that day, we're going to the doctor. We have to go to the doctor. Mm-hmm. I love you. I care about you. Something is wrong, and we need to get to the bottom of it. And she wasn't happy with that, but sometimes you just need to know that the person's not going to be happy with you, but it's still necessary.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Judy. Judy's been standing by as well. Judy, thanks for joining the program. Judy, what's your story?
Oh, well, I just wanted to say that I was just... I just came down with the Alzheimer's, and I'm staying with my daughter Amy, and I live in Valparaiso, Indiana. She takes really good care of me, and I'm very lucky in that. And I have 4 grown-up children and 2 boys, 2 girls, and 14 grandchildren and 4 marvelous great-grandchildren. And I keep in touch with them, and they keep in touch with me and visit me. And I'm also blessed with good friends that I have stayed in touch with over many years. And I just wanted to say that I feel like I'm pretty lucky to have all those people that that care that much about me.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you for sharing your story. And, you know, as Jim mentioned as well, this idea that at a certain point, you know, you have to kind of come to terms with the fact that you have this, and you have to come up with a plan. I mean, that's something that Regan's dad was talking, Dennis was talking about as well. But it sounds like, it sounded from what Judy was talking about, that she's got that.
Yeah, it sounds like she's got a fantastic support system, and you do sound truly blessed, and that's lovely that you share that with us. Thank you so much.
All right, let's keep going. Let's try Tom. Tom, what's your story? What do you want to talk about tonight on the program?
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Hats off to that that woman that just called in too. It was a good story, and she recognizes the problem. But so I'm 64, and no history in my family of Alzheimer's or dementia. My mom actually lived to be over 100, and she was pretty sharp even at the end. But my main question is: are there any medications that could contribute to getting Alzheimer's? And specifically, I've been taking the same dosage of an anxiety medication for 30 years. So is that something that could contribute to my lack of memory, my loss of memory, you know?
All right, Tom, let me bring the panel in on this one. That's an interesting, because we've talked about the other way, that there are no there's no medical treatment for Alzheimer's or dementia. There may be some diet changes and lifestyle changes. But what about what causes Alzheimer's?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of what the association is looking so hard to do through our research programs, is to look at what some of those causes are. I can't say, though, to address this particular issue, you know, I don't know that there's any compelling evidence that taking an anti-anxiety medicine leads to Alzheimer's. However, I would say if he's been taking this medication for a very long time and he's noticing changes with his memory, that he might want to talk to his physician about that and see if it might be time to switch to a different medication. I mean, that might be you know, something that he wants to look into.
Last time I saw my general practitioner, it was a physical, and he gave me a startling fact. I think it was a cholesterol medicine that I'd taken for a while. I was like, and I just need to let you know that this that they're not sure if this causes dementia or not. And I was like, what is that? Like, it just kind of came out of nowhere. But I don't know if that's just, you know, that was the first time I ever thought about any sort of long term. You know, I've had high cholesterol in my life. It has any impact on what might happen in the end of my life?
So there have been some studies that show some relationships between certain drugs and dementia. Sleeping medication is one, anticholinergics, which are things like antihistamines, which I take every day. You know, I take an antihistamine every day. And it sounds like with the cholesterol medication, but I don't think we know at this point, does this cause it or is it correlated with it? So, you know, and you have to make quality of life decisions. Like if you have high blood pressure, you know that if you don't manage that, that's going to be a problem. So
right. 312-981-7200, the phone number. We're gonna get to everybody. I got Randy, I got Grant on the line, I got some texts as well. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about funding too, because this is something that, as we talk about, you know, the medical community kind of coming around, recognizing maybe some of these long-term drugs or medical treatments might have side effects, and also trying to figure out what exactly they can do to diagnose. We also have to talk about what research companies and also the federal government, the state governments are doing to recognize this as well. The lieutenant governor gave us some time to talk about this and her initiatives as well. We're talking about Alzheimer's tonight on the program, Extension 720. We'll take a break and come back. Stay with us. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's our special program tonight on Alzheimer's dementia. The Alzheimer's Association is here in studio, the Illinois chapter. Melanie Chavins, the chief programs officer, Melissa Tucker, the director of family services, and Patrick Reedy, the chapter executive director. We're going until 10 o'clock, and I've got some people on the call, and I want to get to everybody. We've got some stories we want to tell. The lieutenant governor gave us some time, and we also went over to the call center. I mentioned right before the break just this idea of funding. Because you're seeing, as we see the numbers explode and what we might see in diagnosis in the next 15, 20 years, we also see the amount of money it's going to take for care exploding as well. Are governments and state level, locals, federal, are they aware of that? Are they paying attention to the fact that, that care for dementia is going to get much more expensive?
I think so. I think the answer is yes, they are. I think it's still, some of these stats are staggering. So part of what we have an obligation and a platform to do is through our public policy work, make that case to our legislators in Washington, D.C. and also in Springfield. But for the reason I say yes is we've been able to quadruple federal funding for NIH research in just the last 5 years. That tells me that first,
they're paying,
we've got
attention,
amazing advocates that, in telling some of the stories like the ones we've heard from your listeners tonight, and in telling it in a way that's very compelling. And then when you match that up, those personal stories with those, with that that crisis that we're facing, we have seen a change in terms of that federal funding. So we're going to continue to do that because it's, as we've talked about today, we're still not where we need to be. So we'll continue to fight.
And I wonder too, because at the state level, and I was reading this article today about the Department of Public Health and how they signed a new law in that there will be a dementia coordinator that will be able to represent. But I guess the question is, where does the funding go? Is it all about research? Is it for research to try and find a cure? Is it for care, knowing that there's an aging population and there's going to need to be care? Where is the priority at for federal or state funding?
Well, unfortunately, we can't choose just one of those.
Right.
As an organization, we have a commitment to really fight the battle on all those fronts. You know, first of all, through the money that we raise, the Alzheimer's Association is the largest nonprofit, non-governmental funder of research. We're behind only the U.S. and Chinese governments in terms of the amount of money that we do, but also we support in terms of research globally. But yes, those dollars that I just mentioned earlier, that $2.4 billion annually that the NIH allocates towards Alzheimer's research, that's funding at the federal level that Alzheimer's research. We also talked about work, and I know we're going to hear later about some exciting things, including what you just mentioned about coordinating.
Yeah.
here in the state of Illinois, services available, and so we're very pleased that our supporters in Springfield have seen fit to support that position to help coordinate the many agencies that provide care and support for people.
That's the idea, right, of having this czar, if you will, is this coordinator to come in and saying, okay, we've got a lot of different departments that are not talking to each other, and we need one that's going to come in and sort of be the face of, be the voice for the way that we handle dementia and Alzheimer's research and care?
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned before, are people alarmed by these numbers? Yes, they are. So there are a lot of people trying to figure out, okay, what do we do about this? But of course, if those things aren't coordinated, we're going to be working at cross purposes. We're going to be working inefficiently. So the term a dementia-capable state is what we're striving for. Other states have done this effectively. And now, thanks to the support in Springfield that we've received, thanks to the voices that we've raised, we'll have a chance to do this through this position.
I was a little bit surprised and shocked when I read the article that there are only 9 or 10 states that do this, though. When you say other states, it's great. But, you know, it seems to me that this is not a controversial or partisan issue. This affects everybody. And it seems that it shouldn't be 10 states trying to coordinate and get ready for what might be an onslaught of new diagnoses. It should be all states.
We would agree. And we're, you know, proud that Illinois is now helping to lead that.
Good answer. Okay, so when we talk about being the number one fundraiser outside of the federal government, is this something the private sector, I mean, they're not for profit, but is this something the private sector or people outside of government is able to handle? I mean, is this something that you're going to see, not unlike you see with pharmaceutical companies and others, where they take the lead on what they're going to do for finding a cure or delivering services?
Well, sure. So are you talking about specifically the pharmaceutical industry?
No, I'm talking about you guys. Just as a relay, you see that there. But I'm saying for you guys, can you see a future in which you could work to get to better care or research for cures and everything without the federal government?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it has to be a partnership. You know, I mean, I think obviously that's a lot of money, the $2.4 billion. It's not nearly enough to get us where we need to go in terms of research. The funds that we raise that support research, in addition to all the other programs, by the way, that we talked about earlier, the money that we raise supports all the pillars that we've talked about here tonight. But that gives us a chance to supplement. We can also take some more risks with some of those research than NIH might be able to, some maybe higher payoff, but riskier work. So it really gives us a chance to work side by side with, and we work very closely with the NIH to make sure we're doing that.
Guess I would bring up the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, do they have a vested interest? Obviously, it's profit, but did they have a vested interest to say, hey, we want in this game to figure out how to help fund a cure or find a cure for Alzheimer's?
Sure, and the best way we can do that is by lowering the risk, which is funding and seeding and moving forward good research that helps de-risk that investment for them, so that they can make the decisions to put those into clinical trials.
That's fascinating. Okay, the walk is coming up here on next weekend, and I want to give you a chance because I know you got to split. You're taking off because you got to get out of town. But tell me about the walk and tell me about how I can sign up for it.
Sure. Well, we're having this conversation at a really exciting time because we've just completed 24 walks throughout the state of Illinois. So no matter where your listeners are, if they're here in the state, and even if they're not, because of course this is a national program, we've just completed a walk to end Alzheimer's in their local community. 24 of those in the state of Illinois will raise, you know, we'll end up raising more than $4 million to support the really important work that you've heard about here tonight. But it's exciting because we've got one to go, and that's Saturday, October 26th. We're at a brand new location at Soldier Field. That's going to be a beautiful fall day, we know. We'll start with registration at 8 o'clock, and we'll have our beautiful Promise Garden ceremony at 9:30, and then we'll start the walk at 10 o'clock. So we invite anybody, like Regan did a few years ago, to you know, get off the couch.
And what's the website for people to check that out?
Sure. You can go to alz.org, and that'll let you click on the walk, and you can register and join us, and there's still time to fundraise and help fight the fight.
Patrick Reedy is the Chapter Executive Director for the Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois Chapter. Melissa Tucker and Melanie Chavin are here, and they're going to stick around. And I also have a bank full of calls to get to. We continue our special conversation tonight about Alzheimer's and dementia here on 720 WGN. So stay with us. All right, 312-981-7200. Coming up, David Jennings is going to have your news. David, I know this is important to you as well. I know that you have had Alzheimer's and dementia in your family.
Yep.
And, you know, as much as you share, but I mean, this is something that I know, talking to you before the show and pre-show, that this is something that has affected you.
My father and my mother believe at least one or two of my aunts on my mother's side of the family. I used to joke with my doctor, should I get my lifetime pass to Great America now and beat the rush? And she said, you know, we don't know. There are some stories that are, let's just say that my father managed in his infinite wisdom to kill all of my mother's floor-standing plants. I'll let you figure out how he managed that. it can be a shock.
Yeah.
Because it's so out of character that you don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, 312-981-7200. David's got the news right now, and we'll continue here with our Alzheimer's special here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's extension 720 tonight here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Melanie Chavin and Melissa Tucker from the Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois chapter. As we talk about Alzheimer's and dementia, to hear your stories and really spend some time tonight, deep dive on the topic. And to get a better understanding of how it's affecting all of us, as we were talking about all night, everybody's got a story about how Alzheimer's has affected their lives. And let's get to some of those calls, because I promised to get these callers on the line, and I feel bad when we have to go through breaks and things like that. So Randy's been holding for a while. Let's start with Randy. Randy, thanks for joining us. What's your story?
Thank you. My wife was... she was diagnosed with dementia about a year ago, and I have two questions. They'll be short. Does falling down and hitting your hair, hitting her head a couple times, has that any affiliation with dementia?
Okay, that's a great question.
Head trauma can lead to dementia. Traumatic brain injury is one of the things that can cause dementia. So if she's fallen several times and hit her head, that may have contributed to it. Sometimes you see this with football players, you know, or people who are coming back from service. They've had repeated brain injuries, and they can get dementia from that.
Yeah. You had a second question, Randy?
Yes, and me and my wife have been married 41 years, and we're both on Social Security. She's got Medicare and Medicaid. And I have a VA loan on the house. Am I in the future going to have to sell my house to take care of her?
That's a question we haven't even talked about, support and care,
right,
and the cost of all this, especially when people age. Randy, thanks. Hold on and listen in for the answer. But that's a question I think on a lot of people's minds about the cost of all this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. So a couple of things. I'm going to recommend, you know, I recommend this to everybody. Talk to an elder law attorney about asset protection and what you need to do. Many people cannot afford to pay for long-term care themselves. So when people do need to go into a skilled nursing home, a lot of them go in on a Medicaid or a Medicaid pending basis. And there are spousal impoverishment protections in place so that you will not lose your income or your house. That house would be yours for life while your wife goes on to Medicaid to pay for the long-term care. So Medicare does not cover long-term care in a skilled nursing facility for someone with dementia, but Medicaid does. Mm. So I think that's something people have a lot of fear about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm really glad you asked that question.
And it's
confusing.
Yeah.
It's frightening. But before you do anything like move assets around or sell your house or do any of that stuff, I recommend you speak to an elder law attorney about what is the best course of action for you.
All right. Thanks, Randy, for those calls. Let's get to Mary. Mary, thanks for calling in. What's your story, Mary?
Hi. My mother was diagnosed with dementia. She's 87. The question is that we're having issues with, I'm power of attorney, but she's taking money out of the bank and then losing it or hiding it and then can't remember where she hid it. And so I was trying to see if we should do a guardianship because I'm not sure if how that works as far as from what I understand with a guardianship, then you have to she has to be served by a sheriff's department and then she has to go in front of a judge. So I'm not sure if she's going to be scared to do that. And from what I understood from the attorney, that a power of attorney should be okay, except the bank is still allowing her to go and take large sums of money out without my presence.
Yeah, this was an issue in our family, too. That this is probably something, when you get to the simple things you don't think about, like banking and, and care and the things that, that the power of attorney has to deal with.
Yeah, I'm so sorry you're having that difficulty. It sounds like you did the right thing and got power of attorney for finances in place, and you're working with an attorney. So I'm sorry that the bank is not cooperating. Continue to work with your attorney and see what would happen, you know, what you need to do. For guardianship, sometimes people do need to get guardianship if they want to place somebody. Or if they want to, you know, do what you're doing, that does need to go before a judge. But I don't, and I'm not a lawyer, right? But I don't think it would be the scenario that you're describing with the sheriff and the attorney and her being, you know, put on trial. But it would need to go before a judge, and you would need a lawyer representing her interests and you. So if you're not working with someone who specializes in elder law, that's what I would recommend. These are very complicated things. It's a shame that the bank's not cooperating with you with that.
312-981-7200. Let's go to Katie. Katie, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you. Hi. My husband has recently been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and there has been some talk in the Phoenix area with Dr. Burke at Barrow Institute concerning the clinical studies in deep brain stimulus. And there's also a study called the GRAD 2, which has to do with skin injections. Do your professional people have any comments on the clinical studies that are involved with Alzheimer's?
Thanks, Katie.
Yeah, I'm going to start out by just using the disclaimer that I am not a researcher. But I always say to people, there's all kinds of interesting studies that are going on all over the place. But probably if you're looking for studies and you're looking for legitimate studies and you just want to check out a study and make sure that it's a good study, there are a couple of things you can do. Probably the best one is to look at Alzheimer's Association's Trial Match program. So you go to Trial Match on the ALZ.org website. You can look into there. You fill out a quick profile, and then it can come back to you. You can view all the different studies that are going on around the country. Also, if you yourself are interested in participating in research, they'll look at your profile and let you know what studies you might be eligible for. But that's probably a really good place to go if you're trying to figure out if it's a good, legitimate study or not.
You know, as someone who consumes news, and I for this program to get ready for talk shows and other things, I feel like this is the same with a lot of health stories, that I will see every other day some sort of headline about a breakthrough, about Alzheimer's, about cancer, whatever it might be, but there seems, and they're fleeting, they come and go. But what impact does that have on what you guys do when there's a lot of clickbait out there about, and I'm not saying that this one, that what Katie's talking about is not real, I don't know, but the idea of there are a lot of people looking for hope and looking for cures, and there seems to be a lot of news articles and studies about that.
Yeah, there are. I think a couple of things are really, really important to remember. A lot of times when you see something in the media and it says, wow, it looks like there's this treatment that could be, you know, available for Alzheimer's in the next few years, you really have to look into what the study says, right? And sometimes people get very excited about something, and when you dig into the study, you find out that it was just a study with mice. It was a lab study. It's not anywhere near ready, you know, for public consumption yet. So you need to take some of those stories and things with a grain of salt. But I would say if you're considering a trial, you've heard about research and you're not sure if it's good research or not, or you're not quite sure what you should think about it, call the Alzheimer's Association. You can call the helpline and ask questions about research. You can check out our website as well. We have statements on all sorts of research that's going on out there.
312-981-7200, the phone number. All right, so let's get to some of these texts as well. 815 says, no one realizes how early onset Alzheimer's is affecting people. My daughter has Alzheimer's. She's only 53 years old. She has probably had it for about 5 years. Early onset Alzheimer's, people are not getting help. I've talked to so many wonderful people at the Alzheimer's Association trying to get help. This is an issue that I see both of you shaking your head on this. This is something that we don't hear a lot about. I think that this kind of gets overlooked.
Yeah, I am. This is one of the situations that we really struggle with because I know that there aren't resources for this person. And it's so hard. And I'm so sad that you're going through this with your daughter. In Illinois, if you're 60 and up, you qualify for services through the community care program, which can get you in-home care or adult daycare. It's a Medicaid waiver program if you can't afford that. You're not eligible for the community care program if you're under 60 and in Illinois. So if you're 57 and you need in-home care, you can't access it that way. There aren't as many support groups. You're in a different situation. You know,
not a lot of peers, right?
Not a lot of peers. People are still working. This is one of the things that the dementia care coordinator is intended to address. We were talking about that earlier, is to address that gap in care, because we feel this very acutely.
Yeah, it's just, why would there be an age limit on Alzheimer's and dementia? Why say after 60? What is that? Is that did they know that's where they don't want to have to pick up some of the other people who might not be that age? I don't understand.
I think it's because of how things have been structured in the past. And, you know, the majority of people that develop Alzheimer's disease develop it at age 65 and older. And so when older Americans' services are put together at the state level and even at the federal level, you know, they're looking at people over the age of 65. And for many, many years, you know, there was this assumption that you didn't get Alzheimer's under the age of 65. This is why you also will hear a lot from early stage, younger onset, people, that it took them years to get a diagnosis, because if they present to their doctor with those symptoms of dementia and they're under 65, the physician will look for all kinds of other excuses for it because they just don't have Alzheimer's in mind. So I think that's why, you know, because it's usually a disease of aging, those services got put in the departments of aging. We're trying to change that, and we really hope that people will understand that Alzheimer's disease happens at all ages.
Yeah, it kind of blows my mind that way. And, I guess when I think about this, too, you really... Does the medical community, when you're talking about general practitioners or physicians and even specialists in any form, they have to recognize the numbers and have to recognize what's happening. They're trained medical professionals. Do they have to change the way they have to adapt to the fact that people are getting this at younger and younger ages?
Yeah, and a big part of what we're doing as the Alzheimer's Association is getting out and educating physicians and health systems, quite frankly, about the importance of early diagnosis and, you know, how to recognize those signs and symptoms in people, understanding that it happens, it can happen under the age of 65, and just making sure that people are getting proper diagnosis. Mm. I know that several years ago I was at a physician's conference for primary care docs, and I was just shocked at the number of people who came to the association table and said, you know, I don't tell people. I know that I have some patients that have memory problems, but I don't give them a diagnosis and I don't talk to them about it because I know that there's nothing that I can do for them. Mm. And that gave us the opportunity to talk to those physicians and say, well, you may not have something to give them medically, but we have something that we can offer them from a psychosocial basis, you know, in ways that we can help families to cope. So, you know, you need to let people know that they've
got. You don't like to hear that.
Yes.
312-981-7200, our phone number. Melanie Chavin and Melissa Tucker in studio right now from the Alzheimer's Association at the Illinois chapter. We're having a conversation tonight about Alzheimer's, a special extension 720. I'd love to hear your story. I've been hearing from listeners and texters all night long. I got a lot more to get through, and I apologize. I want to get through all of it. And I also want to, when we come back here, play a little bit from our conversation with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, and also a visit to the call center at the Alzheimer's Association. It's extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Extension 720, Justin Kaufman here, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. All right, I've been talking about, we went over to the Thompson Center, State of Illinois building, to visit with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. Juliana Stratton, of course, has been on a listening tour. She has been talking to different communities and different townships in the state of Illinois about Alzheimer's. And, you know, I have to say that this is something that's obviously this is a big part of her job and her work as Lieutenant Governor, but it's also personal, as she tells us in the snippet from this interview. Let's hear a little bit. You're on a listening tour. You're going around the state to learn more about Alzheimer's and dementia and how it affects the residents of the state of Illinois. Why are you doing that?
Well, we started the Through Our Eyes campaign, hashtag LG Cares, because Alzheimer's is something that has personally touched my life and my family. I was the primary caregiver for my mom, Velma. She lived with our family for about 13 years. The last 3 years of her life, she had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's related dementia. And so I was her primary caregiver. I saw how difficult it often was to sort of identify resources to get some of the care. I realized that, you know, how exhausting it could be to be in the role of caregiver, but yet I couldn't really find any real resources for respite. And I also recognized that it was something that you really had to navigate. And through navigating caregiving for someone that has Alzheimer's or that type of dementia, it's very stressful on caregivers. And so when I had the opportunity in this role as Lieutenant Governor to kind of think through some of the things that I would like to do to help people in our state, one of the things that I wanted to do was figure out how we support caregivers. There are so many people, not just from Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's-related dementia, but in so many capacities, people who are in a position of caring for their loved ones.
Right.
And yet they don't often feel supported.
Through going through this tour, I would assume you probably hear from more people than you thought you would about
Absolutely.
How it affects people's families.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it was a six-month initiative initially. We kind of have realized we're probably going to have to continue this work because people are so interested in talking about what's going on, but also have never really felt like this has been something that's been lifted up and prioritized. And hearing from me as someone who has experienced the very same things that they do, many of them are very anxious to not only share their stories, but to also have an opportunity to contribute to the conversation around what we can do better in this state to support them and help meet their needs.
What's the long-term plan? Is this to gather information, to take to the state lawmakers? What is the final on this listening tour?
As we've gone on this listening tour, what we've heard is we've heard lots of ideas about ways that we can do things better. So an example, what can we do in emergency departments to make sure that as people come in, that there's some sort of screening process so that people can be diagnosed earlier, because that's one of the challenges that we've heard. So our goal is not to kind of have this listening tour so that we can just kind of develop a white paper or some document and just put it on the shelf. This is to lead to some real legislative initiatives, some policy initiatives. We want this to be very practical, where it will lead to some real solutions to how we can support families better.
What can governments do to help with this? As it becomes more and more obvious to be one of the big crisis of our time, what can we do? Is it just straight up resources, straight up funding?
Well, I mean, that funding is always something that's going to be a part of providing services to the people who need care in communities all across Illinois. But in addition to that, it is bringing awareness. It's talking about it at this level and saying this is something we know many families throughout our state have been experiencing in one way or another, or potentially could experience, and we want them to be prepared. It is thinking about policy solutions, sort of I talked about before. What can we do when we think about protocols for emergency departments, for internists and primary care physicians? What kinds of geo-mapping can take place so people can know where resources are located? And I think the thing that I've really appreciated about our approach is that we didn't just sort of say it's the same story for everyone. We have talked to those from Black and Brown communities about what are their unique challenges dealing with this disease. We've talked to those who have had younger onset Alzheimer's and what are the specific challenges there. And people in rural communities who don't have access like someone might have in Chicago or a more metropolitan or urban area. So our goal is to bring awareness. It's to think about legislative and policy initiatives, but mostly practical things that we can do that just with those small tweaks and changes, people will feel like at least I know what steps to take so that I can be a better caregiver and have some support.
This obviously is a personal story for you as a lawmaker and the second in command in the state of Illinois. It has to help you to have that personal experience to be able to say this is something that not only affected my family but has affected a lot of Illinoisans, so let's make something happen. Do you see it that way, that this is really sort of a personal mission for your mother?
I absolutely think about it in that way to a certain extent. I mean, I think about her every time I sit in one of these support groups. As I tell just about every group that I sit with, as I'm hearing their stories, there's something healing about it for me because I didn't know how to find resources. I didn't even know where support groups were. I found one at the very tail end of her life. But, you know, as I'm hearing their stories and they're sharing their experience, it reminds me that I was not alone. There are other people. And that's really one of the things that people feel like when they're living with this disease or caring for someone living with this disease, that nobody else knows what it feels like. Right. So I do this in her honor, but I also think more broadly that being in the role of Lieutenant Governor and bringing my lived experience to the table, making sure that I'm constantly coming forward with all that makes up my identity, all that has been the experience that I've had throughout my lifetime, to help lift up the voices of those who I can say from personal experience have not always been included in the conversation.
Lieutenant Governor Stratton, thanks so much for taking some time.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton at her office at the State of Illinois building. And I have to say, you know, real quick, Melanie, you've been a part of some of these listening sessions that have been around the state. You know, what comes up? I mean, is it the same stuff we're talking about tonight? And I mean, are you getting a sense that this is obviously something that's on people's minds?
Oh, yeah. It's the same kind of conversations that we've had with your listeners, people talking about the same challenges, struggling to get their loved one a diagnosis, worried about having to keep him safe. And all of these people expressing how good it was to have a chance to talk and be heard. So it was a great experience to have someone at her level participate in this.
312-981-7200. We come back here in the 9 o'clock hour. We're going to answer the texts and the calls and talk about a couple of things that came up in that conversation with Lieutenant Governor Stratton. Emergency services and departments and police. We haven't talked about that yet and how they respond to people with Alzheimer's and dementia. That conversation as well coming up in the 9 o'clock hour here on Extension 720. So stay with us. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. It is extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312, as I said, 981-7200. Pat's on the line. Judy's on the line. I want to get to everybody here. And we're going to talk with our panel as well from the Alzheimer's Association as we continue our special program on Alzheimer's and dementia. Melanie Chavin and Melissa Tucker are here from the Illinois chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. We had a chance to go over to the call center, and we talked a lot about the call center tonight. And this is, and I'm going to explain it in the piece here. And we had a chance to right around the corner from our office. So the other day, we had the opportunity to get out of the studio and go over there. So here's that report.
Thank you for calling the Alzheimer's Association.
High up in a building located on Michigan Avenue are rows and rows of cubicles. You would think it was just another accounting firm or data processing company, but no, this is the headquarters of the Alzheimer's Association, and the sprawling office space houses phone operators answering up to 1,000 calls a day on the Alzheimer's Association 24/7 helpline. It's available free to the public around the clock, 365 days a year.
Alzheimer's Association, this is Anya. How can I help you?
That's Anya Wiggins. She's been an operator at the Alzheimer's Association for 6.5 years.
How long have you been caregiving for your dad?
And for Anya, this job? Well, it's personal.
I really like what I do because I have been impacted with this in my own family. So it is what brought me here, and if there is any way that I can help anyone, any family in this situation, that's what keeps me here because I know what it did for my family.
Anya and the 130 operators answer questions from those affected by Alzheimer's and dementia. Ruth Drew is the Director of Information and Support Services at the Alzheimer's Association and runs the call center.
Some people call us on the worst day of their life. They call us and they say, today my doctor told me I have Alzheimer's disease. Or today was the first day my mother didn't know my name. Or today my wife thought I was a stranger in the house and I scared her. And so we meet people where they are. We probably talk more with family members and caregivers as the disease progresses. Typically, they're the ones who call us with questions. Some people are just heartbroken, you know, and they are having a tough time watching somebody they care about lose ground by inches. And we grieve every loss along the way. So our role is to walk alongside these folks, to be a safe place where they can talk about what they need to talk about. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we just listen. Sometimes we're able to provide them with really great information about person-centered care and techniques for handling the various things that come up with it.
Yeah, right.
If you haven't dealt with dementia diseases before, you just wouldn't know.
The Alzheimer's Association 24/7 helpline is 800-272-3900. Mm. Ruth Drew, thanks to Anya Wiggins as well and the call center folks who let us kind of bring our microphone over to the space. you know, when she's so eloquent in talking about, you know, people call on the worst day of their lives, or how heartbroken people are as they watch people sort of inch by inch. You know, they don't think about it that way, that you know, you see someone's life disappearing inch by inch. It's really powerful what she was talking about.
Yeah, it is. It's such a fantastic resource, and the people that work on the helpline, the contact center downtown, are so knowledgeable and so compassionate. And I'm so glad that Ruth talked about the emotional support that the contact center provides, because it's not just, you don't have to wait until it's a crisis to call, or, you know, you don't just need a referral for a support group or a doctor, I don't know where to get diagnosed. You can absolutely call and get that emotional support and have an extended conversation. And, you know, we're taking these questions on air right now, and we're being, you know, very mindful of the time. But, you know, if the people that have called in, if you want to get a longer conversation, mm-hmm. if you want to have a really in-depth discussion with a care consultant there, you can do that. And I really encourage anybody who's listening, who needs some help, to call that number and get what they need.
You know, Melanie, when we think about this, support groups have to come. I mean, we haven't even gotten into that conversation. Support groups play such a big role in how people deal with Alzheimer's, not just when they're diagnosed, but when it comes to support.
They absolutely do. And I think there's a real comfort in going to a group where you know other people are dealing with exactly the same sorts of things you're dealing with, where you can talk about what is happening with your family, with your loved one. You can share stories that might be a little embarrassing to talk to other friends about who might not be living through it. You know, I've been in a support group facilitator myself, and it's always been, you know, such an honor to be able to be there and listen to people's stories and to facilitate that conversation. It's just amazing what people get out of the support groups.
312-981-7200. Let's go to Judy. Judy, support groups are important for you, correct?
Well, I really needed one desperately. My mother died a few years ago from Alzheimer's, and I was her sole caregiver. And toward the end, I really, really needed a support group. I did find one in a local church, but unfortunately, everyone in the support group, their loved ones were just beginning the stages of Alzheimer's. And my mother was far more advanced. And so they didn't have the slightest idea what I was dealing with. So I just wanted to suggest, when you put support groups together, I don't know how you would be able to do this, but you do need a combination of different stages, because they vary tremendously. Yeah. My mother was far worse than forgetful.
Thanks, Judy. That's a great question. I mean, when you're talking about support groups, there's different support for different people.
Well, yeah, our support groups are drop-in groups. Anybody can go to them. So usually, I'm sorry that Judy had that experience, usually you do go there and there are people who it's very new to them and people who have been all the way through it. And sometimes people, you know, stay in the groups after their loved one has passed, and they're a source of information and comfort to people. So a lot of times what I hear is someone goes to a support group, their loved one's just been diagnosed, and they get in it, and everybody is more in Judy's situation, and they say, I can't deal with this right now. I don't want to hear this. This is not where I'm at. So usually there is that range of experience. We don't assign people to group. People call the helpline. They find a group that's near them. I always encourage people, try a couple of groups. If you're in an area where there's more than one, you might find one that fits you better, and that's fine.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, think about support groups, and as Judy was mentioning, the idea that sometimes you don't want to hear, if you're new at it, you don't want to hear or be in a support group where people are further along, because that's frightening, or it might not be the support you're looking for. There is a lot of nuances that go along with trying to find the right support group to be with.
Mm-hmm. I think, though, even if you're in that group and people might be, you might be later in the disease and somebody else might be earlier in the disease, I think there's still that commonality, that common experience that you've got, that shared experience of having Alzheimer's in your life. So yeah. I usually encourage people, stick with it for a little while, or as Melissa said, you know, look for another group. And if I could say one other thing about our support groups, the most amazing thing to me about them is they are facilitated by volunteers. These are not you know, staff members or professionals. When I facilitated a support group, that was before I was working for the Alzheimer's Association. These are all volunteers. So a lot of times, if you're a caregiver, a family member, and you've lost your loved one, and you're looking for a role and you want to give back, please consider being a support group facilitator and give us a call. Yeah. You are the perfect person for that.
What's the call center number again?
It's 1-800-272-3900.
There you go. 312-981-7200 is our number. We're going to come back, and we're going to get to Eric, and we're going to get to Pat, and I've got a bunch of texts to get to as well. In studio with us, Melanie Chavin, the Chief's Programs Officer, and Melissa Tucker, Director of Family Services for Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois chapter. Again, a special Extension 720 tonight as we dedicate the program to talking about and sharing stories and exploring Alzheimer's and dementia here on 720 WGN Radio. Stay with us. All right, it's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you. 312-981-7200. We have got, we're going until 10 o'clock tonight on our Alzheimer's special. In studio, we have some people from the Alzheimer's Association of Illinois. Melanie Chavin and Melissa Tucker are here, and we've got people on the call. So let's get to some of these calls and some of these texts. Maybe I'll start with the text that, you know, we talked about the early onset. This is, said their brother had vascular dementia. His daughter and I recognized something was going on with him in 2004. It was several years before his wife agreed. And this is something that I've seen a lot of texts just about. How do you convince not just family members? We've gone over the idea that people who are actually affected by the disease and you're trying to get them to recognize this is happening. But when you're talking about spouses and others who may say, this, you know, I don't think it's that bad, or I think you might be wrong in what you're seeing. How do you deal with that family dynamic? Because that just seems to be... That just seems to be really hard.
Yeah, that's an uphill battle. And, you know, we work with families in this situation. I'd recommend getting all of the siblings together if they have other, mm-hmm. you know, aunts, uncles, being a united front. Get other authority members in. You know, maybe you
get the doctor,
get the doctor involved,
right.
Or if there's, you know, a pastor of the church or somebody that she respects that she'll listen to if she doesn't want to listen to her kids, you know, kind of fighting this on all fronts.
I found that hard, you know, when my grandma was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and then it transformed into dementia. My mom had a hard time, and she would always confide that the hardest part was, you know, making the phone calls to siblings who were all over the country in different mm-hmm. places, and for them going, you know, I just talked to her a week ago. She's fine. Or, you know, she just came down here to Florida and had some sun. We'd be fine. And just this challenge that she went through, this uphill battle, as you said, to almost let people know. And she became insecure about it in this way that, you know, she's like, well, am I not reading the diet? Is a doctor telling me something? Like, she got more insecure because it was difficult to be a one-man band.
Yeah, and that's not an uncommon story. One of the best cures I've heard for that before is families having other family members come to stay with the loved one while they take some time away, because then they see firsthand what's going on with that person. You know, and it's hard because if you're just talking to somebody, you know, once a week over the telephone, people might seem very appropriate on the phone. You know, oh, hello, how are things going? Mm-hmm. Things are going fine. And you don't typically ask questions that would get at, you know, answers where you would be able to notice that dementia as much.
Yeah,
so.
I just know that to be an issue. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Pat. Pat, you have a question about insurance. And we talked a lot about the insurance companies and Medicare and Medicaid and how that all kind of plays out. But what's your thought?
Well, I think the biggest thing is education. A lot of people aren't aware that there are long-term care policies and hybrid policies, and if we talk to our parents in advance, many times getting a policy like that could allow us to be care managers as compared to caregivers. And so whether they should chat with their financial planner or talk to a long-term care advisor, because there are many programs that you can transfer the risk to the insurance company, but as you know, most people don't think they're going to go in, and they hope they never go in. But I think in many cases, it still makes sense to have a plan whether you go in or not.
That's a great idea. We
can be a little bit more proactive and look at the cost and look at the options while we're still healthy.
Yeah.
So come Thanksgiving or come Christmas when you sit down with your parents, say, hey, Mom, what would happen? You know, I'm 64. How would I be affected if my parents needed care?
Yeah.
And would I have to quit my job?
Yeah.
And so parents don't want to be a burden on their kids. And sometimes it's the oldest daughter that ends up, you know, taking care of Mom.
Yeah.
So I've been in the industry for over 38 years. My goal tonight is really just to have your listeners talk to their financial advisor, talk to their parents, and do some planning today for tomorrow.
Right, great. Thanks, Pat. Thanks for that call. Sorry to cut you off there, but that's not unlike what we're talking about. Just this recognition and having a conversation before the conversation is forced.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah, I think it's so important that people have these conversations before there's any dementia. Because as we get older, we're all going to have increased needs. We're all going to have some increased dependency. All of us will probably, you know, need some more help. So even if you don't get dementia, having long-term insurance can be a really good idea that can pay for care in the home if you ever need that, say, following a surgery, mm-hmm. in addition to paying for care in a residential facility if you need that for dementia. So absolutely, everybody have those conversations with your parents, your children, your loved ones. Decide who's going to be a power of attorney. Talk about the kind of care that you want. Set up advanced directives. Very important. Set up those, have those conversations about what kind of care you want at the very end of life so that people aren't guessing or feeling guilty about having to make those decisions when you're no longer able to do so. So yes, it's excellent point.
It's such an excellent point. That's something that we had to go through as well as because, again, you just it's not an easy conversation, especially when someone is going through it. When you think about that, I mean, it almost, in a strange way to hear Pat talk about, hear you talk about it, it almost has, it's an education issue where we all have to think that way. It almost has to be like when you are planning for retirement or all the kind of stuff you see the commercials that tell you about what you're doing with your future. This has to be one of the commercials.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, why do we wait until we're older to have those conversations or to think about that for ourselves as well? You know, if you're from a family like mine where you've had multiple generations of people who have had Alzheimer's disease and you know that that's a concern, those are things that you should be setting up for yourself, you know, a lot earlier. But unfortunately, a lot of times what we do is we wait until we're older and we have to, when we're forced to think about these things. It's really important to think about them when you're younger as well.
Yeah, and I'm throwing a bone to the financial planning industry. You think you'd want to get to some during a football game or something, start putting those ads out, and people, I think, might be more willing to do something. It just seems to me like it's not something that's in the zeitgeist or in the public knowledge that you should probably be having those conversations mm-hmm. before you're 65 plus.
Yeah.
312-981-7200, our phone number here as we're talking about Alzheimer's dementia on a special extension 720 tonight. We'll continue to do that coming up right here after David Jennings News. Again, 312-981-7200. I got a ton of texts I got to get through, and we're going to do that before 10 o'clock. You can also call as well. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, 312-981-7200. It is extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, David Jennings got his newscast within the minute here. Yeah, we've covered a lot of ground tonight on our program about Alzheimer's and dementia. When we come back, let's talk about emergency services. You know, just about whether or not they're prepared, and I think they are, or they're getting there when it comes to training and other about how to deal with patients or people that they're interacting with that may have Alzheimer's dementia. And then we'll also talk a little bit about some of the science and genetics behind this, because there is a lot of confusion about whether or not this is a hereditary disease. If this is something that if it isn't in your family, not unlike cancer and the cancer gene, that it's something that you automatically should be prepared for. I'm not sure that's the case, and we're going to talk about that with our panel in studio. We're talking about Alzheimer's and dementia tonight here on Extension 720 on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number as we settle in for our final half hour on our special on Alzheimer's and dementia. Melanie Chavin and Melissa Tucker from the Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois chapter, are here in studio. We've been taking your calls and talking about various aspects of the disease and really various. I mean, we really run the gamut here in the conversation tonight on the program, but it's a conversation that you just have to have. I feel like, you know, there's a little responsibility when it comes to the media as well, that a lot of times it's about, we're having conversations that are primarily about research or some study that has been put out, but we rarely have comprehensive conversations or holistic conversations about all the different things that are happening. And that's important. And then, and you know, as one texter pointed out, just about that's great that the state wants to, and the federal government wants to put money into research for finding a cure for Alzheimer's or dementia, but what about care? And we kind of talked a little bit about that with Patrick when he was here, but this idea that finding that balance of a disease that does not have a treatment and providing care. I mean, this is that really is. I mean, that's a difficult juggle for any sort of state or federal government.
Yes, it is. And I think it's so important to remember, you know, the research is so important, right? Everybody that I talk to that's dealt with this disease talks about how important it is to them that we find a treatment, that we find a cure, that we find some way of preventing this disease. So that piece is so, so, so important. But we have to remember that there are people who are living with the disease now, and we have to make sure that there are things in place for them. And we've talked, I think, about a whole lot of issues that families deal with. You know, at some point, the person with dementia can't live at home alone any longer. So we need to make sure that programs are funded so that people who can't afford out-of-pocket expenses for in-home care can get something like that. We have to make sure that there's programs like adult day programs available all over. Like in Illinois, I think less than half of the counties in Illinois even have that service available. So, you know, what can we do to make sure that people who need these services can get them today? And so when we're talking about, you know, funding programs on the federal level, it's not just about the research. That's important, and that is a big part of our mission, and we really believe in it, but it's remembering that the people who are living with it today need those services today.
And there's something to be said too, and we have these broad stroke conversations politically about funding social services, and we had or the safety net and things of that nature that have come up over the decade here in Illinois politics. This is what we're talking about, because at a certain point there needs to be some sort of state investment into how we're going to deal with the fact that the numbers are staggering, and they're getting because the population is aging, but also because of advancements in diagnosis, more and more people. I mean, the number by 2050 was 14 million people. Staggering. I mean, that's a number that's hard to fathom when you're talking about a segment of the population living with disease.
Yeah, and it's an expensive disease, right? The out-of-pocket costs for families are absolutely staggering. The cost of Medicare and Medicaid are absolutely staggering as well. And if we just look at those numbers, I mean, you talk about those numbers of people, think about the numbers of dollars that the federal government is going to spend on this disease if we don't figure out something soon.
The other thing about this we haven't talked about, we talk about research and science, but we talk about genes and whether or not this is hereditary, right? Because some will say, oh, yeah, this is, I can see this has happened generation. You mentioned as well, just generation to generation happens to your family. And I think a lot of people listening right now would say, I would automatically think it's genetic or hereditary because I've seen this happen to my parents or my grandparents or their grandparents before them. So where does science land on whether or not this is a hereditary disease?
Right. There's a handful of families that have a deterministic gene where if you get that gene, you're going to get it. And you probably know that because you'll see an entire generation of people, usually younger, will have gotten dementia. But for the rest of us, dementia, Alzheimer's disease, there seems to be a family tendency. Like there can be a family tendency to diabetes or heart disease. But And you can have a gene that increases your likelihood of getting it, but that's not a deterministic gene. So, you know, people, if you've taken care of your parent, people will say to me, you know, I'm just terrified of getting this myself. And that's very understandable. But your parent having dementia doesn't mean you're going to get dementia. And having no dementia whatsoever in your family doesn't mean you're not going to get it. You know, we were talking earlier about those gene tests you can do at home.
Right, like the 23andMe and stuff like that. Right.
So people take that test and they see that they have that gene, and then that's very scary for them. But again, it doesn't mean you're going to get dementia. It may mean that you have an increased risk if you have a copy of that gene. And the concern about those home genetic tests is that, so now you know that you have this gene, and we were just talking about how important it is to get long-term care insurance. Well, there are some implications there for health insurance if you you know, if you discover that you have one of these genes, and since we can't treat it right now, you know, you really have to think carefully. Why do I want to know if I have it? is it useful information to know that you have this gene? Because it doesn't mean you're going to get dementia and just having the gene.
That's the part that I have a hard time with, because any concept in which you're going to have your care affected by whether or not you know you have genes that may lead to a disease is a little bit head-scratching, especially when we're talking about something without a cure. And really, we're talking about care, not necessarily when it comes to the patient, not to the research and so on. There's a lot. I mean, I see it. And how do you educate the public on exactly what you just said? Because I don't know how you do it, because I think a lot of people think it's hereditary. They think that it's something that runs my family. My grandma had it, so I'm going to get it.
Or people think it's somehow contagious. I mean, there's all kinds of myths about Alzheimer's disease. And I think, you know, one of the ways that we do that is we educate, and we make sure that we're getting the messages out there to people about the disease. And we promote the helpline, and we promote ALZ.org, you know, as resources, so that if you have questions or you have concerns about the disease, you know where to go. That's a reliable source of information.
Getting texts in, 708 says, I was a fire department paramedic for 30 years, and we had no specialty training for Alzheimer's, nor the recognizing caretakers who may be in need of help. They said it was an old timer's disease. You know, that's a great point, and I'm glad that this texter pointed in. I think there's been strides in how emergency department services, both the paramedics and the emergency rooms and the police department, they've definitely done much more when it comes to training than maybe when 708 was working at the fire department.
Yeah, that's so true. We have done a lot of outreach and advocacy. We recently passed a legislation for something called the Silver Search, which is a state police initiative. And if someone is missing, they have dementia, they're driving, that alert will go out.
It's like an Amber Alert.
Right. Yeah, Silver Search. And part of that is education for first responders, because it is important. You know, what you heard me recommend earlier in the call, you know, if someone is really agitated and they have dementia, you want to call paramedics. It's important that paramedics know how to respond. If a police officer sees someone who's obviously confused and disoriented, it's important that that officer understands what dementia is. So we're doing a lot to do that outreach and provide that education.
How do you do that? How do you educate a police officer to know what dementia is? I mean, that I would think that that'd be a difficult proposition for people who put their lives on the line to, and they're dealing with someone who might have dementia and is showing rage. How do you do that?
Well, we work with the Illinois State Police and train some of their folks to do that training. You know, it wouldn't make sense for somebody like me or Melissa to walk into a police department and train them about Alzheimer's disease. You know, we don't have the same language. We're not part of that culture. You really need to have somebody who is part of that culture to do that. The Alzheimer's Association also has an online training program that's available for first responders called Approaching Alzheimer's. And that's available online for anybody who wants to take it. And that also is very, very specific to the needs of different kinds of first responders. So we understand that this is an issue, and we're out there trying to make sure that these first responders have that training.
The other thing would be the emergency room services and doctors as well, because we talked a little bit about practitioners and how they can, you know, deal with early detection and that kind of thing. But when you're talking about bringing in someone who might be in the throes of dementia and they're showing some of the symptoms like rage or confusion or whatever it might be, how do you make sure that the emergency room doesn't just approach it face value and say this is a combative patient and I don't want to deal with it?
That's a great question. What we do is we really urge the family to advocate for admission into the ER in those situations. They have to be there at the emergency room saying this person has dementia. It's not safe for them to come home. They're a danger to themselves and others. They cannot go home with my 76-year-old mother. She's too frail. You have to really urge the hospital to admit them in ER, and then hopefully they'll be seen by a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. That's the course of action that you want. You want them admitted, and then you want them seen by someone who understands that this is a brain disease.
Yeah, I would only assume, because if one of those, and a texter had pointed this out too, is that when they bring their dad in, if dad is showing rage, the nursing care, others, they don't want to deal with that. They don't want to deal with a competitive patient. I can understand that. I mean, on face value, we're like, I'm not getting in the way of somebody who's out of control. But if that's the symptom, of dementia. How do you provide dementia care?
Right. Sometimes people have to go to a geriatric psychiatric unit. So that's a place that is a psychiatric unit that can cope with that. The staff can cope with it. And it's a geriatric psychiatric unit, so they understand dementia. There aren't that many of them across the state. Sometimes people have to be transported a long way away. This is really upsetting for the family. It's never a good time to see your loved one in a psychiatric facility. But sometimes that's the level of care that that person needs so that they can, you know, have those psychiatric symptoms addressed. This is a product of the degeneration in the brain, that that impulsivity, rage, and it needs to be treated. It's very distressing for them. They're in pain. You know, they're in pain. They're afraid. They can't cope with what's going on, so they need an appropriate level of treatment.
And when we talk about appropriate level of treatment, and I know our family went through this as well, that you are seeing, at least when it comes to nursing care, you'll have almost advanced levels where you have Alzheimer's care, but then dementia wing, and it seems that at least when it comes to homes and nursing care, that you are seeing at least an understanding that there needs to be more care as the disease progresses.
Yeah, the long-term care industry, I think, has really responded well to this. You know, I think for a couple of reasons. One is just from a pure business model. I mean, you've got all these people out there that are living with Alzheimer's disease. It doesn't make sense not to recognize that and not to put together special programs for that. You know, families are asking for it too, that this is a big thing. You don't want to place your family member in a care community where they don't have an expertise in dealing with people with dementia, and where they're not training their staff in how to deal with the different symptoms and signs that you might see.
Yeah. That's Melanie Chavin. She's the Chief Program Officer, and Melissa Tucker is the Director of Family Services at Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois chapter, talking about Alzheimer's dementia tonight on Extension 720. We'll take our last break here, and we'll come back and wrap up the program. 312-981-7200 if you want to get in before the bell sounds at 10 o'clock here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Extension 720 wrapping up here. I believe Pete McMurray's coming up at 10 o'clock here on 720 WGN. Our program tonight dedicated to Alzheimer's and dementia, and we've been taking calls and telling stories and exploring themes around the disease. Let's go to the line here and get Sandy involved before we wrap up. Sandy, what's your thought?
I had a couple thoughts. I sing in nursing homes and memory care homes and other senior homes, so I'm around people with Alzheimer's and dementia a lot. And one of the things I notice are the family members are always trying to really change the person that's got Alzheimer's or dementia, and they tell them things like, you just need to think, and things like that. And what they need to really try to do, and I think it would make them happier, and it would also make the person with Alzheimer's and dementia happier, is if you just accept that this is going to be their new normal and try to make them as comfortable as that you possibly can. And if they start declining, then you just have to adjust. They don't need to adjust.
Yes.
They're doing everything they can just to make it through the day. And I think a lot of family members don't understand that. And telling them that they need to concentrate or trying to think or things like that, it's not helpful to them. I think if you boost them up and make them feel good about whatever they can do and can't do, I think it makes them happier, and I think the family members would be happier too in the long run.
Thanks, Sandy. Thanks for that. That's a great point. I think that's something we've been talking about tonight. But, yeah, the new normal.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to meet the person with dementia where they are. And the people that work in residential care and in adult daycare that understand dementia and can meet that person where they are and also educate the family, they're doing a tremendous service. It's such hard work. And we do that a lot, too. We emphasize a lot how to communicate with the person with dementia, and we try to teach families ways that are not going to frustrate them and the person that they love.
And text tonight as well, talking about nursing care and people who dedicate their lives to this. You know, we've talked about the state of Illinois And we've talked about the country and federal funding, but this is not only an issue for this part of the planet. This is happening everywhere when it comes to human beings. Margaret in Bridgeport asked about the Dementia Village in the Netherlands, and how are other countries and other places in the world handling Alzheimer's and dementia?
That's a great question. So we have the Alzheimer's Association here in the United States, but there's a group called Alzheimer's Disease International, and there are Alzheimer's-related organizations within countries all over the world. And they're all doing interesting work. The Netherlands, the Dementia Village, that is so interesting. And kind of piggybacking on what Sandy just said about needing to enter into the world of people with dementia. This is a whole, basically town that has been built around people with dementia. And, everybody in the town has been trained on how to deal with and work with people with dementia. There's a store that's set up where people can come in and they can buy things. They don't have to have money, but they stock the store with things that people might like. There are activities and things that are going on within that town that are appropriate for a person who has limited memory and limited cognition. It's very difficult for someone to get lost. The elevator that they have in one building that goes from the first to the second floor, you don't ever even have to push the button. You just get into the elevator and it takes you to the floor because they know that people might forget. So thinking about that and thinking about how we can design environments around the needs of people with dementia is pretty fascinating.
Do you think you'll see that kind of thing in the United States? I mean, is that something that you think might head this way?
It's starting to happen. You know, here in Illinois and in a lot of other states, there's a real movement toward dementia-friendly communities where, and a community can be defined as anything. It could be a church. It could be a city. And cities and towns are saying, we really want to make this place dementia-capable. And so they decide how they want to do that and what they want to do based on the needs of the people within their community.
Yeah. A fascinating and fantastic show tonight, talking about the stories and of people with Alzheimer's dementia, the caregivers, the family around, and exploring the disease itself. As we wrap up here in our last question, just, you know, you guys dedicate your lives to this, and you've, you know, obviously you hear these stories over and over. As you look at the way that the numbers play out, that we're going to have an explosion of diagnosis and more people and more all this kind of stuff, are you hopeful for the future of this world with Alzheimer's and dementia?
You know, I am. I really am. I think there's a lot more awareness of the disease. We have more people like Sandy who are recognizing that people who are living with this disease deserve dignity, you know, deserve to be treated in a really great way. There's some amazing research going on right now all over the world. Right now here in Chicago, so the Alzheimer's Association has an initiative called U.S. Pointer, which is looking at different lifestyle interventions. Mm. So exercise, diet, and we're doing studies around the country and recruiting people that would be willing to be in this study. And there's going to be a study here in Chicago, and that will be announced very, very soon, and we're really excited about that. Mm. The big promise, I think, in Alzheimer's research right now is looking at ways that we can maybe prevent or slow down the disease and reduce risk factor. If we could find a prescription of exercise and diet and all that can help to reduce the risk, what a great thing that would be.
The walk is coming up here on October 26th. You can find that at alz.org. And also, you can sign up. It's going to be at Soldier Field coming up here in Chicago. I can't thank you enough for being in studio tonight. The Alzheimer's Association, the Illinois chapter, Melanie Chavins, the chief programs officer, and Melissa Tucker, the director of family services. Patrick Reedy was here earlier. He had to leave for a flight. Thank him for being here. But I want to thank you both for being here. And I also want to thank everybody who called in and text tonight as we had a good conversation together about this very important topic when Alzheimer's and dementia. Thanks so much for being on Extension 720. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having
us.
Thank
you.